possession number 24629, Reel 6.
Seen in the centre of the convoy. Columns about half a mile apart, other than in bed.
Lieutenant Commander Collis, RN, Reel 6.
Then went to HMS Triumph. Well, Triumph was the cadet training ship. The naval cadets at Britannia Royal Naval College, Dartmouth, had to do some sea time during their time there, and they had a training ship attached to them. It used to be HMS Devonshire, and then HMS Triumph took over. Now, Triumph was a light fleet carrier, again rather like Ocean, and we had three aircraft on board, and they were three Balliols. And the idea was that we would have 220-odd cadets doing their sea training, and at the same time we would fly these Balliols and give them trips in the air. It was a means of recruiting for officers to join the Fleet Air Arm. Well, that went well, and we had some illustrious captains. Two of them became full admirals. One became Admiral of the Fleet, Sir Harold Begg, Governor of Gibraltar, and those other things. And he was a nice man, because as a captain, I was one of his officers and one of the division officers in training. And he never forgot one. When he was the Admiral of the Fleet and First Sea Lord, I was working for NATO, and I went to a conference at Greenwich Museum, college, not museum, and the we were having a coffee break, and suddenly there was a bellow down from the senior officer's table, sort of thing, of my Christian name, you see, and I turned around, and there was Admiral Begg, and said, "What are you doing here?" you see, and came halfway across the room to meet me. And all these NATO pundits, you know, were looking to see, who is this little lieutenant commander who knows the First Sea Lord? So on Christian term names. And he was a charming chap, and very sad when he died. But anyway, Triumph was a training ship, and I had the forecastle. And this is, I had quite a number of, let's see, how many? I think it was about 75 cadets all told at that time, under me. And I was responsible for their training, their welfare, and everything else. And they were a splendid bunch of chaps. Some of them retired from the Navy fairly early, others went on to become admirals, and quite a lot of the extra flotilla were cadets under me. And for instance, there was one officer I had there who was one of my assistants, and he called Mike Livesey. And I was ashore the night before, because we got very friendly. We had a pilot on board called Peter Lamb. He was obviously known as Sheepy Lamb. Now, Sheepy Lamb was a very good pilot, and he was the first chap to drive a hovercraft, amongst other things. Anyway, he and I were ashore, because we had become friendly with the headmistress of the Codrington Girls' School in Barbados. And because we used to, in the training ship, we used to do three cruises a year. In the winter, we went to we went to the Mediterranean in the winter. In the summer, we went to Scandinavia, and in the spring we went to Caribbean. And we were off Barbados this particular time, and nothing to do with us really, but it just so happened to coincide with the MCC touring team being in Barbados. And we, I'd been ashore with Sheely the night before, and we'd missed the last boat back, so we stayed the night ashore, and that wasn't very difficult because you just sat in the balmy sort of evening air, drinking Planter's Punch or whatever your fancy was. Anyway, we went to find a just by just on dawn, to see if we can find a local boat to take us off. And we found one. But as we were approaching towards the ship, one of the training boats had detached itself, because the first thing of the routine of training the cadets in the morning was before breakfast they all did boat work. So one of the training boats had detached itself and came speeding towards us. And sure enough, it was one of my cadets who brought the boat alongside and said, "Good morning, sir. We have brought your uniform and thought perhaps you'd like to change before we get back to the ship," you see, which is very good of him. And Sheepy Lan dived into the cabin and stayed out of sight until, because the commander was around and he was watching possibly what was going on. And I changed into uniform and drove around and behaved quite normally as if we were doing our normal training, you see. Now, the chap who had organized that was my second-in-command, called Mike Libsey. Now, I thought it was full marks, and I thanked him very much for it. Mike Libsey ended up as Sir Michael Libsey, 2nd Sea Lord and CNC Home Command. He fully deserved it, too. But it's a small incident. And then, having finished with Triumph, I then went to stand by a brand new ship building in Devonport. And it was the first ship to be built by Devonport Dockyard after the war. And that's HMS Salisbury. And Salisbury was what we call an AD frigate, aircraft direction frigate. And she was a frigate, but she was the size of a destroyer. And she was propelled through the water by 8 diesel engines. And we had 4 diesel engines on each shaft. And you can connect up 1, 2, 3, or 4, you see. And so you could go off with 1 diesel engine on each shaft, which gave them enough power to drive the ship at 7 knots, which was quite powerful. Anyway, we used to do, or could get up to about 28 to 29 knots, and the only snag about these diesel ships was that when you berth a ship in any port or dockyard or things like that, there's always a little man on the quayside who says 10 feet ahead, captain, you know, and so you have to move 10. And what we used to do was to phone up chief in the engine control room and say, "Chief, give her a flick ahead," and he would just put the throttles in and out like that to get the propeller to turn over like that, which would be enough to push us up 10 feet. You know, give her a flick ahead or a flick astern or that sort of thing. But it's a very funny way to maneuver a ship, but anyway, it worked. And we had to go out and do trials after this ship was built. And, of course, when you do trials with a brand new ship, you take along the builders with you, you see. Well, I said to the captain, I don't know how many of the dockyard mateys had ever been down the coast, and I said, "Could we, in doing our steam trials, go down the coast and I'll point out various points of interest in the coast of Devon and Cornwall, you see." And quite enjoyed it, I think, having a look at these places. And we're doing our steam trials, and we got to Land's End, and and then we went out to the Wolf Rock and round the Wolf Rock and back again to Land's End, and then back to the Plymouth Sound, where we anchored again. And those trials had gone all right, and everything seems to be working pretty well. There was one more trial to do, and which we were going to do the next day, and that was to steam astern for a length of time, for 6 hours. Okay? Well, the Salisbury class of ship had a square stern, and the propellers, the shafts and the propellers, were slightly inset into the ship in tunnels. And when we went astern, the captain said, "All right, you know, we'll reverse the trip to navigation lights and we'll steam astern." And he said, "I'll face aft and I'll see where I'm going." So I said, "Fine." And I said, "While you're doing that, sir, may I take a party to see Eddiston Lighthouse?" And so I took a party over there, called on the lighthouse keeper, and took him the daily papers, which he was interested in. He was interested to know what we were doing, you see. So I told him, and he said, "Oh, I wonder what you were doing." And he had a few stories to tell, particularly about fishing by kite, which I'll tell you another time because it's too long now. Anyway, we went back to the ship, and the ship was having trouble, because after going astern for about 2.5 minutes, all the engines started to seize up. So, why was this? And we tried 3 times, and each time it happened, same thing happened. And they started to get hot and seize up. Well, the captain said, "Right, back to the drawing board," sort of thing. So we went back into Devonport Dockyard, and all the pundits from Bath and everybody came down. And our own engineer came up with this, why it had been happening, and came up with a solution, which was very simple. And most things are simple, and the simple things are the good things. You wouldn't know, I suppose, what a Drysdale pump is.
Well, I've heard of one, actually.
Yes, well, a Drysdale pump is a pump that circulates water. Now, so happened, quite by chance, and these things do happen by chance, that the Drysdale pump that circulated the seawater around the engines to cool the circulating water of the main engine, it was an exchange cooling system, you know, one jacket on top of another, and had been positioned in the ship's engine room right on the waterline. And this meant that when the pump was working, half the bottom half had water in it, but the top half had air, and thus the pump didn't work properly. So now the air had got into the pump through going astern, square stern against the sea, a tumble fall over like that, with air inside it. So air went down underneath the hull and went up these 2 tunnels where the shafts were, and up into the cooling water, got stuck in the Drysdale pump. So the pumps didn't work, and the whole thing packed up. And thus, the engines got red hot and came to halt. So they said, "Well, we'll have to rebuild the thing." And our engineer said, "No, we don't have to do that. Why don't we get rid of the air?" So they said, "How are you going to do that?" He said, "Well, when air comes up the shaft's tunnel, and it gets into the suction pipe, have a pipe into the suction pipe that goes up in the engine room above the waterline and is open to the top. So as air gets sucked in, the bubble wants to go up to the top and goes up this pipe and expels itself to the atmosphere inside the engine room. The rest of the water goes on up to the pump and the pump keeps working." And it worked.
Mm.
You see? And it... you know, simple things, but it worked. Anyway, had quite a bit of fun in Salisbury. Stop the tape a minute. Then Salisbury was first of a class, and as such we did a lot of experimental work. And it laid the foundations for future ships of that sort. But, of course, this modern day and age, we now have better systems of looking at the oceans and looking at the sea. I mean, to say, I was in Salisbury, just out here, off Torbay, and we had on our radar screen a complete picture of the channel. Well, now that's a slight freak circumstances and gave us that. These days you can get that with satellite communications and various other things, so that, you know, Salisbury is a bit out of date now, I think. In fact, we sold it to the Indians. But from Salisbury I went to, as a lieutenant commander, to HMS Cavendish.
What date was that?
That was in 1958. And she was the Captain D ship of the 6th Destroyer Squadron. And we went out to Malta to work up. And it was, you know, an interesting time to see Malta again, and also to drive a big, powerful destroyer. Because when the captain was away, I used to take his place and drive the ship. we were going, there was a time that the Cyprus troubles were on, and we kept a Cyprus patrol to stop immigrant ships and things like that around the place. And to stop an immigrant ship, or to stop any ship for that matter, is very difficult at sea unless you sink it. That'll stop it, but how do you say stop, you know, if the chap doesn't want to stop? It's not easy. So what we used to do with the destroyer is to go up alongside the ship as much as we dare, and the ship would be going steaming along, and we'd steam up alongside it and drop an anchor into the hold of the ship. And then we'd stop ourselves and pay out the anchor cable, and eventually we would put strain on the anchor cable and physically stop the ship. Because we were a fairly powerful ship, and going astern on our engines, we could stop the ship. And the cable wasn't going to break just like that. What used to happen, sometimes the bulwarks of the ship that we were trying to stop used to come flying out. but it had effectively a way of stopping them. We were, you know, it was the Cyprus troubles, the Palestine troubles, and a certain other. And before I left Triumph, we were sent to the end of the Palestine Mandate, and it meant that the aircraft enjoyed themselves, our aircraft enjoyed themselves, because they could fly down the Sea of Galilee, and Galilee is below sea level, you see, so they could then boast they'd been flying at 230 knots with nothing on the clock, you know, because they were below sea level. But it was quite interesting to watch the invasion of the great Egyptian army, which came to nothing, because we had two gangs there in those days, the Hergam Vaizrumi and the Haganah, and they were both Jewish, but they were fighting each other to see who would gain power, and they were both fighting the Arabs at the same time. And if you were in a tank there, 10 to 1 it was driven by a Jew, so you got out of the way, fairly smartish, because he'd soon as run you over as not. But we were there to get our own troops out, which we did. And they had some Auster aircraft, little Austers there. Now, our method of getting them out was to fly them on, you see. But with naval aircraft, you need about 30 knots of relative wind speed over the flight deck to get them airborne, our aircraft airborne. Well, Auster aircraft, you don't need 30 knots, you need about 10. So we had to steam into the wind, because they were flying into the wind to land, but we had to slow down, because these little things were flying, and flying hard over our deck, but they couldn't land, you see, because the wind was too strong. And so what we devised was that we would sort of slow down gradually, and as they were flying over the deck, sailors would rush out, grab hold of it, and pull it down. And this is what we were doing. Pulling them down and holding them down, you know, and getting them on board. You know, the first time I've seen sailors actually manhandling an aircraft out of the sky. But anyway, I went to Cavendish, the leader, and we went to Malta to do the workup. But we were going on the Cyprus patrol. Now, this meant that we had to steam from Cyprus, from Malta to Cyprus. So on the way, we were carrying out some exercises, and one of the exercises was to fire some dummy torpedoes. Now, that's fine. You fire a torpedo, and it has a blowing head on it, as opposed to an explosive head, and at the end of its run, the engine stops on the torpedo, and the torpedo bobs up and down, and with the head showing above the surface, you see. So you could go down and pick it up, because you didn't want to lose the torpedo mechanism. Though, the captain turned to me one day and said, "You pick it up," you see. So I went up to the torpedo and stopped, and we were still slowly going ahead, so I wanted some stern power, you see. So I rang down, you know, slow stern. Nothing happened. Rang down again, slow stern. Now the captain was standing, and this is a Captain D, the four ring captain, standing on the bridge beside me, and nothing happened. And suddenly there was a great whoosh of the propeller, and the torpedo disappeared underneath, and quite frankly buggered up the screws, because it got tangled up in the screws and broke one of our shafts. So we'd stopped everything, and then we tried them out, and the ship started to shake, and because the thing had come unbalanced. And so we had to go back to Malta. Now, it was a lesson to learn for the whole of the engine room staff, really, because you have a boiler room and you have an engine room. Now, they're separated, you see. Now, when the bridge rings down to the engine room, wants to go slow astern, the engine room telegraphs through to the boiler room that we're going to go astern, thus we're going to use steam in turning the engines over, going astern. Now, the boiler room guys know the pressure of their boilers, and if they've got too much pressure there, they'll wait till somebody starts to use some of it, you see. Now, the engine room were waiting for steam to come through to turn their engines. So they were both waiting for each other. And thus, the order wasn't obeyed. And thus, we got tied up with the torpedo. Lost the torpedo, also broke the propeller.
Would the captain have been in trouble over that?
Well, this was the point. Who was in command? Well, the captain appointed me, but he was still the captain, he was still there. So the question was, whose fault was it? And the board of inquiry said it was the engine room fault. So the captain was exonerated, I was exonerated, but the engine room was fault, and so it died a natural death. I think it was a bit of the old boy shaking hands together, and it died a natural death. But it was a lesson learned, and the engine room staff should open up whether they got steam or not. And as soon as they open up and the steam is being used, then the boiler room should have supplied more steam. Mm. Anyway, I don't know whose fault it was, really. But so we then left. Oh, that's the other thing. While in Cavendish, I had a fire to put out in Cyprus. We had a range in Cyprus to shoot at. part of the northern, well, the northwestern tip of Cyprus. It was uninhabited, and it was woodland and sort of gorse and mountainous, and so we used to shoot at it. But we approached this target and we saw some flames. The gorse was burning, you see, and quite a big woodland nearby. So I was looking at it with the captain, and I said, I think I could put that out, you see. And he said, how now? And I said, well, you know, we have a big portable pump on deck, which is ready for sucking out the, if we're sinking, getting rid of water. Now, if I took a hoses enough ashore with the pump and the suction hoses for picking up the sea, because it wasn't very far away from the sea, I could use the hoses with seawater to pump to put the fire out, which we did. And while I was there, they said, there's another fire, which the ship had seen, higher up the mountains. Go up and see if you can put that out. It wasn't very big, they said. So we trundled up the mountain, myself and my little party of Stokey boys, and we got up there and found two of the airborne soldiers there. And so I said, what are you doing there? And of course, the airborne soldiers have no respect for the naval ranks or naval people. And they eventually virtually said, what the hell's it to do with you, anyway? And I said, well, they've reported a fire up here. And these two guys were smoking. And I'm bloody certain they started it. But we put it out quite easily. And I still don't know what those two soldiers were doing there, because there's nothing for them to be there. And I eventually reported to the captain that I met these two soldiers, and he reported it to headquarters. Who they were or what they were, no idea. And they weren't going to tell me anyway. And I didn't think it was a good idea to start having a bust up with two airborne soldiers. So, well, then I came home from Cavendish, and in 1959, I joined HMS Hermes, which was building in Barrow, and eventually we got her commissioned, and I left her in 61, and then went to HMS Excellent, in command of the regulating school, which is the naval police, which was an interesting job in some ways. And then I went for exchange service with the Canadian Navy. And for 2 years I was over in Canada, which was, that was interesting too.
Did you find their methods different than the British Navy?
No, not really, because they were all sort of British trained. They had slightly different attitudes. I was there at an interesting time. I was assistant planning officer for training, and they had a minister called Hellier there, and this was the time that the Canadians were trying hard to gain their independence and have their own flag, and eventually they decided on what we used to call the Canada Packers flag. They used to changed from the white ensign to this flag, you see. So all the Navy changed. Now, I was working with not only Canadians, but some American naval officers. And so the American naval officers said, hey, gee, we've always respected the white ensign, you see, and I said, yes. So they said, well, why don't you get hold of a white ensign, and we'll have it hoisted here, and then we can have colors of our own. So I wrote to Gieves in London, and they sent me a small white ensign which used to sit on my desk, and we used to solemnly have colours every morning. And it was an interesting time in Canada, because it's the first time in my life I've ever been licensed to drink liquor. You can't drink in Canada in the open air. You have to be undercover. And we, as NATO officers, were allowed duty-free booze, you see. But we had to go to a certain liquor store, and we were only allowed duty-free booze of one kind. In other words, if I wanted gin, I had 12 bottles of gin, and I couldn't change it and mix it up. And there were six of us, so we all lived in different parts. Some lived in Quebec, others lived in Ontario. So we had to secretly meet to arrange who was going to get what, you see, at this monthly booze